Before I start episode 55 of Talking Prisoner, I would like to issue a content warning for our viewers and listeners today. In today's conversation, we will be delving into some potentially distressing topics relating to the experiences of individuals on death row. We'll also be discussing matters of life, death, guilt, and redemption, which may involve talking about violence, crime, and the emotional trauma associated with these issues. We want to give our audience a chance to decide if this conversation is right for them at this moment. If these themes may be distressing to you, please feel free to step away and join us for another time. For those who choose to stay, I hope this conversation sheds light on the experiences within the prison system and brings greater understanding to the important work being done by individuals such as prison Buddhist Susan Shannon. Welcome to episode 55 of Talking Prisoner. Today we're peeling back another layer of the complex and often misunderstood world of the prison system. We've spoken to actors, writers, and production staff before, but now we're venturing into the very heart of real-life experience in correctional facilities. We're privileged to welcome Susan Shannon, an accomplished prison chaplain, to our show today. Susan's extensive career spans over a decade and a myriad of facilities, but her most striking experience, and the one we'll be delving into today, revolves around her time spent working on death row, offering spiritual guidance, comfort, and a listening ear in an environment categorized by its finality. Susan has been a beacon of hope and compassion in the bleakest of situations. So without further delay, let's welcome Susan Shannon to Talking Prisoner. Thanks for coming on today. It's an absolute honor to have you here. There we
thank
go.
Thank you so much. It's an honor to be here.
No, thank you so much. And please excuse me that I'm going to be referring to a lot of notes. I do have a lot of notes written down.
Okay, sure.
About
yeah.
Things I want to talk to you about.
Excellent.
But before we get stuck into it, I want to learn a little about your childhood growing up. Where did you grow up as a child?
I grew up here in the Northwest. I was born in Seattle, grew up in Edmonds, Washington, which is about 15 miles north of Seattle.
Wow. And what was your childhood like, school and everything like that?
It was okay. I didn't really care for school. I didn't feel like I was able to study what I wanted to study, especially when I began to become exposed to things outside of the general curriculum, such as involving Buddhism and Eastern religion and things. So I began studying those things when I was 14.
Oh, wow.
And yeah, on my own. And then didn't always make the best grades.
Yeah.
But I got writing honors and a few scholarships.
Oh, fantastic.
Yeah.
And do you have any hobbies that you like to do in your spare time? That's if you have spare time.
Hobbies. Oh, what a question. That's like a koan to me. I have so much going on in my slow world here on the island with 8.5 acres of property to tend
to.
Yeah, beautiful property with a lot of stewardship and involved, and circling around that is my work with chaplains and ministers.
Yes.
And my teaching, and then my Buddhist prison ministry, which has grown enormously in just a few short years since I formed it in 2020. So hobby, not so much. I like to think of every day as a get to. Everything is a get to. And in order for that perspective to be maintained, I feel like I take a lot of time when I, you know, just to hear that what the trees are saying and pet the dog, and it all seems to get done.
It all gets done. Fantastic.
Yeah.
Now, before we get into what we're here to talk about today, we share a common interest, which is The Sopranos.
Yahoo!
Fantastic. Yeah, I absolutely love The Sopranos, and I work with some of the cast members with my memorabilia business. But what's your favorite episode?
My favorite episode. Oh God, I hate to be the favorite episode person. You know, I have to say, I guess I have to say it, it's Pine Barrens.
Yeah.
You know, there, after watching the whole series 9 times, it's really hard. I kept track of favorite episodes once in a notebook, and it's just too many.
Oh, so you've written 9 times. I was going to ask you that question. Wow.
Yeah.
You beat me.
Yeah.
I think I've been five.
Well, it's new every time I watch it.
Is. You got a favorite character that you like on the show?
Yeah, I feel like Polly actually got me through my prison work, and part of being able to do the kind of hard work I did inside had to do with me being able to channel my inner Polly.
Yeah.
So there were many times when somebody would come up to me and I'd hear Polly, you know, I don't know if I can cuss here, but
Yeah, no, please. Yes.
oh, okay. You know, I'd hear Tony Sirico going, "Are you fucking kidding me?" And I'd be sitting there going, So it enabled me to keep, yeah, there's a lot of manipulation that goes on in prison. And part of the intrigue in watching the series so many times was really fine-tuning my radar about the early steps of getting played, the early steps.
Yeah.
You know, because you can see, you can feel when you're obviously getting played, but in prison and in Tony's life and the others, you know, you have to know kind of ahead of time when the game's going down.
Definitely. And I know everyone talks about it, but the ending, what do you think of the ending of The Sopranos? And please,
Oh, I was
watch The
a
Sopranos. Stop this now and go and watch it. Spoilers.
right. Yeah, I think that I was asked that in the Talking Sopranos super fan episode. I don't remember what I answered, but since you're asking me right now, the ending, I felt like it was perfect. I
Yeah.
felt like it left a both and. It left, there was a moment there in the ending where our brain, or my brain, and a lot of people's brains just kind of hit an evaporation point for a moment, going, what? You know, what? And that's a really precious point. And there was so many teaching moments in The Sopranos that to end on that note, it was kind of like the Zen, you know, the quats being hit with a stick, or the koan, or, and I also feel that it left the series open to going either way if it was to have a season 7.
That's what I love about it. It just
Yeah.
left it open. You know, you could think two different things. And I really think, you know, I see a lot of fans commenting on different things about the final episode. And I really think it's 50-50.
Yeah, I do too.
People think he's alive, people think he's dead, you
Yeah, 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 yeah. Once the disappointment, you know, people, a lot of people felt let down, like it was a cheap trick.
Yeah.
But I think that just had to happen to fill that sort of pop culture instant mentality before the real sort of juice of the moment was able to simmer and ferment.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. Now, for the viewers and listeners, can you explain Tibetan Buddhism, please?
Oh gosh.
I know, look, I know we could be here for hours, but if you could just give a brief overview for the listeners and viewers that don't know.
Sure. Yeah, okay. So yeah, the elevator speech, that's so funny. Well, there are a lot of different traditions of Buddhism, and Tibetan Buddhism differs, and this is Susan speak here. Some, you know, a lot of grounding in the text and accuracy, but this is Susan speak here, is that so Tibetan Buddhism is a part of the Mahayana aspect, the Mahayana branch, if you will, of Buddhism. And what sets that particular soup aside is that a person is dedicating themselves to really working with their own stuff for the benefit of all. And that for these days and for my life, working on my stuff, my psychology, the things that come up, that's been most transformative. And it gets to a point where, when you really apply the teachings of Buddhism, of Tibetan Buddhism. There are specific practices that allow us to inch closer, just like we were just talking about the last episode, to that moment where the outer world and the inner world are so in alignment that this is where synchronicities happen and karma ripens and, you know, the world starts doing you versus you kind of being in the world. And with that added addition of being a benefit of the bodhicitta, the awakened heart, it's like you get a whole different job assignment in this lifetime. And I know for me, having gone from, I've been practicing, studying Tibetan Buddhism for over 50 years now.
50
and
years. Wow.
Yeah.
Oh.
And it wasn't really until 10 years of real deep difficulty, losing the use of my arms and hands, losing everything that I had built in my life, fighting through all kinds of bureaucracies, that I really began to see how buoyant the practices are, because I was able to kind of turn those into that situation to where I saw this is a grinding stone for me.
Yeah.
You know, this is going to grind me to where I can be of much better service. And looking back from that period of time, when I began to see like dogs would come to me with tight collars and they'd be barking and really mean, and it happened so many times, and I'd loosen their collars and they'd become friendly. And I thought at the time, if this is how I can be a benefit, then this is great. This is a manifestation. And then fast forward to 15 years later, when I'm going into death row.
Yes, which we will talk about.
Right. So it's like Tibetan Buddhism allows the whole mandala of your outer life to be the sandpaper you need to come up through your own, you know, the manifestation of your being. And that is what I love about it. So
yeah,
scaffolded,
wonderful.
So beautiful.
It is. I've read a lot up on it. And when you say 50 years, has it changed a lot from, let's say, maybe the 70s to now?
Oh yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Well, in I started studying Chinese Buddhism, and I went to Taiwan and studied in the temples and monasteries there a bit and studied Chinese. But when I got turned to Tibetan Buddhism through a commentary on the Heart Sutra, I began to, that's when I saw the Dalai Lama for the first time. In 1979, he came to Seattle, and I went and I had like a 5-hour out of body experience.
Wow.
You know, it was only for the local Tibetans. Almost nobody knew who he was. And I just disappeared out of my body and was found on the curb like 5 hours later by a friend. But then I went to more teachings, but at that point in time, you didn't just pick a lineage. It wasn't just like, I'm going to be a Dzogchen practitioner. I'm going to only do Nyingma. I'm going to only do Kagyu. You took teachings, or I took teachings from anybody who came through. And some of the time they didn't even have a translator. You know, you were lucky if they had a translator and it would be in somebody's basement. And, you know, so it wasn't for a number of years that I really realized that I had taken teachings from a lot of different lineages. And then I began to kind of categorize them once the, over the 80s, more lineage holders began to come, and they began to establish centers, which then people could go, oh, that's a Kagyu center. Oh, that's a this center, you know? And these days, well, pre-COVID anyway, and you know, these days there's a whole lot of lamas and monks and nuns and Westerners, and which is great, and it makes it kind of harder to discern the actual purity of lineage. So I feel fortunate that all of my teachers have been some of Tibet's greatest scholars, and I got it, you know, straight, no chaser. And then to have the whole being of my life totally dissolve through, you know, issues related to the body, I feel blessed. And yeah. I'm grateful to be asked to help perpetuate the understanding of the Dharma whenever I can. No, thank you for that question.
No, thank you for answering. And the Dalai Lama, I mean, have you met him more than once?
Oh, yeah. Well, met him. I've attended probably 35 or so teachings with the Dalai Lama in person. Yeah, a lot back in the day. And in 1989, he came to Mount Tamalpais. And my daughter's father was known to have a beautiful ceremonial tent that was made by somebody up under the Dalai Lama back in the 60s and 70s. And so he was asked to bring his tent for His Holiness's green room, you know, for his sort of backstage. And we all got in for free. My daughter's father had actually lived with His Holiness or next to him back in the early 60s when he first came to India. Yeah. So we got to serve him tea. And that was one of the handful of really close encounters I had with him, you know? Yeah. Yeah.
Wow.
I hope to go and see him maybe in February.
Fantastic.
In person, and thank him for a life, you know, for leading my life for all these years.
Wow. Amazing.
Yeah.
Now, San Quentin, is it Quentin Prison? San Quentin? You pronounce
Quentin?
It?
Quentin.
Quentin. Quentin. Uh-huh. So my apologies. San Quentin no Prison. Now, I'm just going to, for the listeners and viewers,
yeah,
that don't know about this prison, it was established in 1852 and opened in 1854. It's the oldest prison in California and the state's only death row for inmates and the largest prison in the United States. It has a gas chamber, but since 1996, executions at the prison have been carried out by lethal injection, although the prison has not performed an execution since 2006. Please correct me if I'm wrong on those facts. Now, 2008, $395 million was allocated for a new death row facilities at the prison, but two legislators introduced bills to eliminate the funding. The state had planned to build a new death row facility, but Governor Jerry Brown cancelled those plans in 2011. Now, Johnny Cash performed twice at the prison, and B.B. King recorded live at San Quentin in the prison, which won a Grammy Award for Best Traditional Blues Album, which I had no idea. And also known for inmates such as Charles Manson and actor Danny Trejo. How did you start your chaplaincy at the prison?
At the prison? Well, I had just been ordained as a interfaith minister and chaplain. And I was about to finish my master's in divinity program. And I needed one more class. And it had to be Friday morning. And the only class I could take was prison ministry. I hadn't really decided to work in a prison.
You hadn't thought about it at that stage. It was just
not really. No, not really. I had just worked for a number of years, almost two decades, with Tibetan monks.
Wow.
In a few monasteries. So working with men is okay, you know. And I'd also been working with middle school kids in restorative justice and emotional literacy. So in this prison ministry class led by Father George Williams, we had a weekly requirement, which was to go into San Quentin once a week for 2 hours and do their restorative justice program, which was music to my ears because I love restorative justice. So I went in and with the class, and that night and every night for months, I felt like I felt when I started going into the monasteries, I felt like I'd found my new monastery, you know, like the prayer wheel of my heart was spinning, and I'd lay awake at night and there'd be this narrative of that was way beyond me. And I just, you know, that was my place. So, but I also knew it was energetically very challenging, potentially.
Yes.
So I increased incrementally by doing a semester of field work after Father George's class, and then doing my four units of, it's called clinical pastoral education. It's what you need to do to become board certified as a chaplain. So I did all that at San Quentin. So I had all these hours I needed to spend.
Wow.
And that's how I ended up going in. And I also, most of what I did was facilitate a lot of different rehabilitative groups.
Yeah.
And then the Buddhist chaplaincy on death row came shortly after. And I can tell you about that too.
Yes, definitely. Please. I do want to ask, I mean, what was it? I've watched a documentary on this prison, and I've got to say, it looks like a really scary, scary place. I mean, what was it like walking into that prison for the first time? I mean, it's renowned for being a scary place and a place. And I mean,
I know, you know, I don't really have fear, I don't think. And that's what enabled me to do what I did.
Yeah.
And I didn't find it scary at all. I found it intriguing. I was never scared there in all the years. Even one night when I got kind of stuck on death row, I wasn't afraid.
Yeah.
And San Quentin, it's not one of those prisons in the middle of the cornfields in the middle of, you know, redneck country. It's right there on the bay. So there's all that negative ions from the waves coming in, the view of San Francisco Bay when you walk in. And then even though there's the clang and there's the seriousness of your ID and bags and all that, then you come out onto this incredible rotunda that it was surrounded with roses that the one or two of the inmates took care of, beautiful roses, hundreds of them. And then the chapels over here, and all the cell blocks were over that way. So going into the cell blocks was more like what you might see at MSNBC, with two guys in a crowded cell and little TVs and sitting on the toilets and writing on the toilets. But San Quentin itself, also the kind of, I guess it's plaster or alabaster, took on a beautiful, and I don't like to use the word beautiful when I talk about prison, but I have, and I continue to, is just this luster of like Rembrandt light when the sun would come down like this. And so, you know, there's a saying in a few traditions, Buddhism and Taoism, of cultivating the eyes that see that which is awakened, and to see that light and to know that that light coming down over the mountain has given so many men so much hope, let alone the care with the gardens and stuff like that. I never found it to be a frightening place.
Okay. Wow. I do want to read something from a statement from Christine Shimrock, who's a Catholic chaplain at Connecticut's Lebanon Correctional Institution. She said the warden determines how much latitude she has as the religious liaison between administrators and inmates. If there is a warden who doesn't value religious programming, then you find yourself battling even the simplest request guaranteed by law, she said. But more times than not, wardens are very, very careful about making sure that religious rites are honored in their prison. So do you find it's a battle with what you're doing within the prison system?
Oh my gosh, yes. And just to be just, well, a battle, more like a constant, more like Groundhog Day, you know,
okay.
But you're always coming up on the same like roadblock.
Yes.
So it's, but I want to make a point here is that the California prisons, and I think most prisons except for federal, only hire Catholic, Protestant, Muslim, Native American, and Jewish chaplains. So I got in as a Buddhist chaplain by way of credentials and a endorsement by a monastery. And that's how I was able to go in, and I was paid through a grant. So I wasn't a staff chaplain, but I worked with the staff chaplains. And the way it was run at San Quentin, and I think most prisons now, is that the other you know, faith traditions, other besides those five, they get kind of handed out like cards to the staff chaplains, who rather begrudgingly often will go, okay, I'll take the Krishnas, or okay, I'll take the Buddhist. And lucky for me, Father George was a big advocate of Buddhism, And he pushed to get me approved to go into death row as a Buddhist chaplain, starting with providing spiritual support for a well-known Buddhist on death row, Jarvis Masters.
I have a lot of questions about Jarvis, actually.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so that's how I was able. And so, but in my other role as being a facilitator and a program starter, you know, through my hours I needed to fulfill, I worked with red tape all the time and I got really good at it. I did. Everybody liked me. I followed chain of command. I have a huge respect for everybody, you know, that works there. And compassion. And I worked real hard when I very first went in of having the men in green, the guards, and the blue, the inmates, being able to hold equanimity and caring in my heart for them equally, you know, because it's so easy to take sides, especially when you hear stories.
Yeah.
And so I got most of my requests pushed forward.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, but the staff, but also because I was not a staff chaplain, I had a lot more freedom to spend on all the time it took to do that. The staff chaplains, meanwhile, you know, the sentence that wasn't in that quote you read was that the warden will try hard to make sure spiritual needs are met to prevent a lawsuit. So,
has there been lawsuits or because?
Yeah, you know,
wow.
Because people have a right to have support for their faith tradition.
Yeah.
And, or if not a lawsuit, let me roll that back a little bit backwards in the process. And in the California prison, what's called a 602, which is kind of like a grievance. But it's a grievance of enough import that has to be dealt with up the chain. So there was an inmate that found out that Jarvis and I were having one-on-one Buddhist meetings, and he is a practicing Buddhist too, and he wanted to get in on it. So he had written a 602, not about me or Jarvis, but saying, hey, let's do a Buddhist service, and this is why we have to do it. You know, the laws say this, blah, blah, blah. And that was my foot in the door.
Wow. Wow.
And I'm happy to say that inmate has been removed from death row as of last week and is now in a level 2 prison. And he is hit the ground running with helping people learn to meditate and starting a Buddhist program there. Just wow. Amazing.
Is that Albert Ruel Jones by any chance?
No, but love him.
Okay.
But did you read my review of his book?
I have. I said, I've got a lot of notes to talk to you.
Oh, cool. Oh, I love Rue. Yeah. No, this is Maurice Harris.
Oh, I read that one as well. Yes.
Yes, okay. Yes.
Wow.
And I want to say that because, you know, back to what is Tibetan Buddhism, the fruit of it. And I always told the guys, this changes your inner, kind of like your vibration, you know, when you really apply yourself. And if we're beings of energy, then how we vibrate, it's like two guitars in a room is going to pull new things in.
Yeah.
It's as you transform, so are your outer conditions. And, you know, to see this happen on death row time and time again, what a petri dish.
And he was released from death row. Is he being released from prison? It's like the
Not right now, but he was released to a level 2 prison.
Okay.
Which is, you know, mainline. It's much, much, much lower security and doesn't have to be shackled and can interact with people as a human being, you know, and probably is going to have a cellie and can program and stuff like that. Yeah, just amazing.
Some of the current inmates on death row at San Quentin, Richard Boyer, sentenced to death in 1984. Vincent Brothers, sentenced to death in 2007. Albert Brown, sentenced to death in 1982. Brandon Browner, sentenced to death in... Sorry, I haven't got the date for that one. David Carpenter, sentenced to death in 1984, is the oldest inmate currently. I could go on, there's a lot more, but what I found was, so there's a lot of inmates that have been sentenced to death many years ago. Why is there, just a question, there's such a big gap? I mean, they don't know when they're going to be executed. They're just sort of every day is they're just sitting there waiting.
Well, not quite. And, you know, I'm not a criminologist, but what I do know is that when I was there in San Quentin on death row, out of, at the time, I think there was either 705 or 720 inmates on death row, 18, only 18 had exhausted their appeals.
Okay.
So those who, you know, and with the execution stopped, then those 18 are in line.
Okay.
So that's what I know.
Yeah. Because there hasn't been an execution since 2006.
Yeah, six or five. I forget exactly when it was.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Now, US Today had an interesting article saying too many innocent people are languishing behind bars. A study funded by the Department of Justice estimates that the rate of wrongful convictions is up 11%, or more than 200,030 people of nearly 2 million held in prisons and jails throughout the USA. Defendants able to appeal their convictions are forced to battle a broken system that can take years and in some cases decades of filings, motions, and hearings. Now, is that like inmates on death row don't have access to be able to prepare for their case for appeals? Is that what they mean by that?
No, I don't think so. Inmates on death row can have legal visits.
Okay.
Yeah. And so usually they have lawyers. The appeals, you know, are quite challenging and long term. So don't think I've ever heard of a death row inmate doing a case by himself.
Okay, you know, so we're able to.
Yeah, that would be near impossible.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. No, I just thought I'd ask that.
Yeah.
Yes. Now, Jarvis J. Masters, who's been incarcerated at San Quentin for 41 years and on death row for 32 years for a crime he did not commit. Now, can I just read something about Jarvis just before we talk about him, just for the viewers and listeners that haven't heard of Jarvis J. Masters? His early life was a horror story whose outline we know too well. Born in Long Beach, California, his house was filled with crack, alcohol, physical abuse, and men who paid his mother for sex. He and his siblings were split up and sent to a foster care when he was five, and he progressed quickly to juvenile detention, car theft, armed robbery, and ultimately San Quentin. While in prison, he was set up for the murder of a guard, a conviction which he landed him on death row, where he's been since 1990. At the time of his murder trial, he was held in solitary confinement, torn by rage and anxiety, felled by headaches, seizures, and panic attacks. A criminal investigator repeatedly offered to teach him breathing exercises, which he repeatedly refused. With uncanny clarity, David Sheff describes Masters' a gradual but profound transformation from a man dedicated to hurting others to one who has prevented violence on the prison yard, counseled high school kids by mail, and help prisoners and even guards finding meaning in their lives. Mm-hmm. Now, you work really closely with Jarvis. Can we have a chat about Jarvis?
Yeah, we can talk about Jarvis. I'll be careful and be appropriate if I need to. Yeah.
When did you first meet Jarvis? How did that all start?
Oh, it was amazing. So when I started going into with the prison ministry class, we had quite a reading list, and I'd always heard of Jarvis's books, but I think they were on the reading list, and I read both of his books, and the Lama, who is described in David Sheff's book Chagdo Tukul, was one of my teachers.
Oh wow.
Yeah, back in like, the early 80s, I met Chagdo Tukul. He came to our house and stayed and recorded and stuff. And I took teachings with him. In fact, he told me one day that I was pregnant before I even knew it, like way before I was pregnant.
Wow.
Yeah, way before I knew I was pregnant. So when I started going into death row, I was thinking, how amazing. that Chagda Tuku has Jarvis over there, because that's where Death Row was, and me coming in. And so I imagined Tara over Death Row. Every time I came in, I imagined Tara, the deity of the divine feminine, and caring and, you know, loving and all of that. And one day I was telling Father George, I said, he said to me, I think Father George probably said, you know, there's an inmate on Death Row who's a Tibetan Buddhist too. And I said, yeah, I read about him, and we have the same teacher. And Father George's like, what, really? And he suggested I write down something, I think. Like, so I wrote down all my Chagda Tuku stories, and I was going to give them to Father George to take in. And Father George, like, getting into Death Row as a volunteer is no easy deal, and it might never happen again. I don't know, but it is really hard. And the conditions were just perfect at the time that I was going in. But
and when you say it's really hard, you mean as in like security clearance,
background
checks, and everything like that.
All of that, everything, you know. And so one day. This months are going by, and one day I came into the prison, and I was on the 10th day of a fast, and I thought even that morning, maybe I shouldn't go, you know. I was getting
10 days of fasting, like nothing at all,
right? Just this sort of a balanced supplement that I was taking that supplied calories, so I was feeling okay, but you know, I was getting kind of particulated, you know, in terms of perception and all.
I intermittent fast every day. I've been doing that.
Okay. Yeah.
So 16 hours a day that I don't eat. And towards the end, it can get a little bit.
Yeah. You know, when you're in a place of challenging energy for sure. And so I decided, oh, heck, I'll just go in. And as I was leaving after a long day, I said to Father George, hey, did you ever give Jarvis those stories? And he goes, no, you know what? Why don't we go over there right now? And I'm going, oh, no, right now? Death Row on my...
Oh, so you hadn't been there prior to this?
No. Wow. No, I hadn't gone in yet.
Yeah.
So, you know, and so Father George took me... I said, okay. And he took me over there. And all the while I was walking through the cell block, you know, the alley, the aisle, whatever, and into the belly of the beast. And being grounded and breathing and doing mantra and trying to come back into my body so I could, you know, be present for this.
Just what you've explained there, walking into the beast, is that like what we see on TV, you know, those American jail shows, that, you know, those levels? And
oh, well, I hadn't gone into the levels yet, but that is probably the, like, the small intestine of the beast. But wow. I was walking into the belly where there were the buildings got taller, and they were, there's this cell blocks after cell blocks that were these monolithic cement buildings. And then, but then you hang a left, and I was like Mr. Magoo walking behind Father George. He'd stop and I'd bump into him, you know, and I was just like, ah. And so then you turn abruptly to the left, and there is this gothic black lettering that with filigree that says Condemned Row in big letters above. You could see images if you Google above a door that looks like you're going into some medieval torture chamber. And so there I was. That's how I met Jarvis. I walked in, they vested me up with a bulletproof, stab proof vest, which I had to wear every time that I went in. I was scrutinized with my clearance. They relied on Father George. We walked down the long, the cell block. We walked the long floor level with four tiers stacked, cacophony of chess moves and sports hollers and food requests and TVs. And we stopped at this one cell, and Father George called for Jarvis. And I looked in, and the razor wire is really trippy, you know, it like you look in it and people begin to kind of strobe because of the way the diamonds of looking through the wire is. It's really optically strange. And Jarvis comes right up. And Father George introduces us, and we looked at each other, and it was like everything dissolved, and all there was this universe of knowing.
Is this in his cell? Like, are you like in person?
Yeah. He was in his cell, and I was outside. I was on his front porch, as he called it.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. And there was this instant knowing and connection that I think David wrote about it. I've written about it. Jarvis has talked about it. And it was like we re-met each other, you know, after lifetimes. And Father George was getting a big kick out of it. And he said, hey, why don't we get the guard and see if the chapel's empty and we can go over there and you guys can spend more time in a more relaxed way. So that happened. And then
the chapel was an old bathroom, is that right?
Yeah, an old shower.
Wow.
Yeah.
And it got converted to a chapel.
Yeah, converted into a chapel.
Wow, amazing.
It was amazing, with a gun rail above it, you know, like in a guard up there with his big rifle.
So just for the listeners and viewers, can you explain the chapel? Because your group started with one and grew up to 65. Is that right?
Yeah. But not all those 65 could meet at once because of the way that prison classifies inmates.
Yeah. So how do they meet in the chapel? I mean, you're all just sort of sitting around in like on the chapel? Or...
Yeah. Yes and no. With embellishments. If I had guys, like at first, as word got out, I had guys from different yards, meaning different designations, and there were only three, they called them treatment units, which are basically cages, like treatment units or something like that, modules, or they're basically phone booth size cages.
Okay.
And there were three in the back. So for a while I was limited to three. And in that case, the different guards, their rides from the tiers would shackle them, bring them down. They'd do their capoeira dance to be unshackled, backed into the cage, and I'd sit in a chair in front of them. But once we got bigger and bigger and bigger, then yards would come, meaning like, I don't know, the most maybe was 8 or 10, maybe more than that, 12 people, probably 10. And then we could be in the chapel proper, which was in front of those cages. And it was, I think, five really heavy hewn beams, again, medieval, you know, worn, bolted into the ground. And the inmates would be let in one by one. And because they were in the same yard, they knew each other, they could play handball together, they could play basketball together, you know, they could hang out together unshackled. So they would sit on the benches, and I would sit on this raised platform, again with the razor wire between us, and I would be there.
Wow. I mean, putting on a bulletproof, stab-proof vest and sitting in there like that, I mean, absolutely not scared whatsoever.
No, I liked my vest. It felt like it was comforting, actually. It was also, I don't want to be totally swearing, but it was a mind fuck to be sitting there, you know, and exploring Buddhism with these guys, wearing a bulletproof, stab-proof vest.
Yeah, what an experience.
It's like, that was just totally exciting to me.
Wow.
Yeah.
Amazing. Now, Jarvis has written, is it two books that he's written as well?
Yeah, he's written two. I'm pretty sure he's got another one coming.
Wow.
Uh-huh.
Amazing. We'll throw some links up on the website to his books.
Good, yeah.
And his case is currently being reheard. He's appealed the case, and it's currently through the court system at the moment.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, mm-hmm. You still speak to him, or
from time to time. we talk. It's tricky to get phones you know, through the prison, and Jarvis is walking a straight line with doing using the phones that, you know, prison phones. And so we are in communication. The last we spoke was a while ago, and he was offering, actually suggesting, to do a fundraiser for my Buddhist prison ministry, which I love, because he and I always knew that one day we would have to give up our one-on-ones, because the heart of our teacher, Chogdon Tukul, it's all about spreading the Dharma. And for us to be able to be united on death row and have the same teacher, it was clearly to continue Chogdon Tukul's work, you know? So after I left California and started the Buddhist prison ministry, that is a continuation of, to me and to Jarvis too, the seed that grew between he and I.
Amazing. And we'll put a link up to your website where people can actually donate.
Thanks. Ministry. Yeah, that'd be great.
Yeah, fantastic. Now, I mean, I could talk a lot more about Jarvis, but I mean, we are limited on time. But Morris Harris, who we spoke about before, is a dedicated Buddhist practitioner and activist. Without him, now this is taken from your website, my death row Buddhist Sangha would not have increased beyond Jarvis Masters and I. Mo is always fighting the good fight, whether it be about inmates' rights to tablets, which he has succeeded, right to healthier food and conditions in prison, or more. Mo is a mover and shaker. He was also one of the 8 men on death row who gave me an excellent feedback as I created the Introduction to Buddhism course book. Now, working with Morris, what's that been like?
Oh, he is such an inspiration. He would come to each meeting that we had on death row with the biggest grin, and he had the biggest stack of books, and he was studious. He was meticulous with standing up for inmate rights and doing it in a way that was respectful. He also, at first I was a little challenged, because the school of Buddhism that he adheres to, I became familiar with it when I was back in the early 70s, and it was known as something else then.
Okay.
And it's since become reformed into more of a Mahayana, pulling several similarities from Tibetan Buddhism and things like that. So I was like, oh, I don't want to, I don't know. And then I realized, with Mo's incredible dedication and him bringing new material and me getting up to speed on the transformation of the SGI School of Buddhism, it's been great, you know. And also, it's been right in accord with my goal, which was to provide education and practices on all the teachings and practices that all the schools have in common, not just to focus on their differences, but to focus on their similarities. And so we had one of our first groups, people were saying what tradition they adhered to or were familiar with, and it began very quickly to be this boys pissing contest where, you know, there I was in front of all these death row inmates, and they're starting to argue about traditions. And I just said, no, you guys, that's not what we're going to do.
They're talking about their favorite baseball team. Which one's the best?
So Mo has been really great. He gives me he's given me feedback through the formation of the workbook. And like I mentioned, I just got a letter from him last week, and he's already settled into being a beacon of Dharma for inmates at the new prison he's at.
Wow. It leads me into my next questions for you. He was talking about better food in the prison. Now, what's the typical food for inmates on death row? Is it the same as the general prison population? Or
yeah, I think so. That food is very processed, you know, within like over years and years, if all you had, let's say, was spam and peanut butter and mashed potatoes, you know, eventually you're going to have a favorite, right? And so the guys did have favorites, like, oh, it's pizza night, or oh, it's this. I mean, the mainline guys, because those are the ones that I learned more about, all the real day-to-day stuff.
Yeah.
But the meals seem to be the same, and they're highly processed. They're pretty low quality food, given the incredible rate of diabetes and other, you know, other obvious health detrimental health effects of living in prison. Better food is really sought after, and most especially better vegetarian options.
Yeah.
You know, the prison, the call it prison loaf. It's kind of like, you know, like oatmeal hamburger mush baked halfway or something, you know.
Yeah.
You probably saw Rue, who I think we're going to talk about, Albert. He's got a cookbook out.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Wow.
It's called Our Last Meal.
Okay.
And it's all recipes that a death row inmate can cook out of ingredients they can get themselves from the commissary. But that
they can actually cook them their own food in there.
Well, the mainline, could the death row guys? Anyway, I'd have to remember that detail, but it's a cookbook. And
wow.
You know, high salt, guys who want to do vegetarian are limited to super salty beans and cheese, and a lot of them are gluten, you know, gluten intolerant, and it's really real, let alone the brain food that is needed to actually do the rewiring that is hopeful for those who are going to be released.
Yeah.
So I met many guys who were vegetarian and tried really hard to mediate the quality of the food with other things that they could legally get from the canteen, or, you know, people could send.
Yeah. Wow.
Yeah. Pretty poor.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And what's a typical day for an inmate on death row? I mean, are they allowed outside? I mean, are they in their cells are quite small. I think I read it was a 8x3 or 8x4.
I think it's 9x4.
9x4.
Like that.
Yeah.
Yeah. They're small, and they get out. Well, a typical day, you know, it's weird since I didn't spend a 24 hours there. What I can give you as my best estimate, having gone in at many different times of the day, is that night on death row is almost like day on death row. It doesn't really get dark. It doesn't really get quiet. Unless you are way up at the top, you can't see out windows.
Wow.
And so it's kind of probably a little bit like what they say about parts of Alaska in terms of actually getting sleep, you know, or getting a circadian rhythm kind of thing. People call man down all the time when somebody's sick, or they're themselves are sick, or there's an emergency. There's always bells. There's always guards have to come around and do count, and then do suicide count, and there's med distribution. And I think when the day would start, very few death row inmates have jobs. On the mainline population, the more kind of level two guys that I worked with, they would start work sometimes 3:30 in the morning to start kitchen work.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And then like a typical mainline day would be in San Quentin anyway, would be like get up 3:30 to do your kitchen job or whatever job, then do programs throughout the day, and then maybe go to the cafeteria for dinner or the chow hall for dinner, maybe not, and then maybe do programs in the evening and be back in the cell around 8 plus, you know, 8:30 or something. So very different with death row. They get out for, I think I said, half hour handball or exercise and legal visits, and that's kind of it.
Wow. So they're not allowed to work. There's no jobs for them to do in death row.
There's a few.
Yeah.
Just a few.
Yeah. And what, I mean, what are they allowed to have in their cell? Is it similar to what the general population, the prison can have, or are they limited to what they can have?
Well, they're limited to space. I think they're all limited to something like 6 square feet, or, it's very small amount, 3 square feet, and which is why the tablets are such a great thing, because now tons and tons of reading material can be loaded.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. And for somebody like Mo and a few others in my Sangha who were real scholars and students, like my house is filled. I've got a library of books I study every night. And there are a few guys like that who are real scholars and they want their texts.
Yeah.
So that's really hard. But most guys had a TV with headphones, a CD player, a fan, some little desk set up, even if it was like just sitting backwards on their bunk and using their bunk as a desk, not a shelf. People did, if they did their own rinsing things out, the sink is multi-use, as is the toilet seat. So yeah, Jarvis, and they can have posters and pictures on the wall. Jarvis's cell went through several changes when I, over the years that I saw him.
Yeah. Wow.
It's like looking at into a monk's cell, only when you turn around, you're in a prison.
Yeah. Wow. That's interesting. Suicide on death row is that common? Does that happen?
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. Yeah. That was one of the kind of energetic, challenges of going in there all the time. Was I knew that environment could wreak havoc on my body if I didn't have really good energetic protection. And that's why I didn't mind my vest, because it was a symbol for that for me. But I did a lot of visualization just protection wise. A death row inmate told me once that he thought every cell on that block, in the whole unit, had a suicide at least once.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah. Suicide's really common. It's kind of like it, or it is in some cases, the last freedom to take one's own life. And aging on death row, I mean, imagine what we know of aging, right?
Yeah, definitely. Now you just you just mentioned about protecting your energy. I interviewed Governor Eddie Mullins from Mount Joy Prison in Ireland just recently. And a question I asked him was, running a prison and being the boss of a prison, going home, was it hard for him to switch off from the prison and the emotions run through? Is that similar for you, or are you all constantly thinking about the inmates on death row?
Yeah.
The support you give them?
Just a second. Visitors here. That's why I took it incrementally, because I didn't feel like I could integrate any more programs or activity in the prison until I could sleep without having that narrative going, So yeah. the 2 hours a week for restorative justice slowly led to a semester of field work with 14 hours a week, which slowly led to CPE 20 hours a week. I had to learn on the fly how to deal with the visuals. So my work here on death row, and then here with the mainline. With the mainline, I led several groups, three of them, which made it mandatory that the inmates disclose the details of their crime.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So I heard hundreds of crime stories in great detail.
I don't know. That was one of my questions. Any of their crimes shock you? I mean, that you sort of go, I can't deal with that. I mean, you wouldn't be human. I mean, it was a question that I asked a governor was,
you see
a court case on TV, that inmate's going to come to your prison. How do you find that balance between the
Yeah.
two?
Well, on death row, I really didn't want to know what guys had done, you know? And it's different over there. Nobody talks about their crime over there.
Oh, they don't. Okay.
Yeah, but I did have I did pick up information now and then and about certain inmates, and that was really that could be a challenge. There was a couple serial killers I worked with, and to see, oh, actually, there was somebody there on the death row who had committed his crime in my very small community.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and I had ended up doing a whole benefit for his victims that was a celebration of hip hop called skate culture for this
Oh, wow.
person. Yeah, and then here he shows up in my sangha. And so you can bet I did some agility in my brain and my heart with that. And, you know, to ground it into the beauty, the preciousness that these men are wanting to dedicate their lives in a different way, combined with the realization of how badly they must have hurt to create that kind of harm.
Wow.
So that was death row. The main line, on the other hand, I learned right away that I needed to implement deep breathing, feet on the ground, the recognition of suffering. When somebody would begin the details of their crime, I had to listen for disconnects, because this was all about accountability and responsibility. I had to listen to bypass, you know, possible leaving out details and things like that in a supportive way. But I also had to keep my feet on the ground, breathe deep, employ that visualization of protection, and recognize again how badly this person must have hurt. That, with an overlay of seeing in my mind's eye, through the restorative justice lens, the first responders, the family members of the inmate, you know, the ripple effect of the incredible depth of interconnectedness that happens in these kind of occurrences. So the only crime that was, of course, I heard a lot of very, very difficult things. One of the most difficult ones, though, was there were a few times when an inmate who I had worked with for a number of years wanted to confess something that wasn't in, that they hadn't been convicted for. And that's when I was fully in my clergy hat, you know, of being the chaplain. And two of those were really hard, because I had known these guys for a long time and I never would have suspected. And I also felt like, and I knew their crime, I knew what they were convicted for, but I never saw these other confessions coming. I couldn't have imagined it. But I also, you know, you do a lot of things in those moments. And over here was the deep honor that they trusted me so much to share that with me. And the prayer, I'm a very much of a prayer chaplain, prayer Buddhist, that the removal of this from their heart, you know, open the channel for healing in them and with everybody that they come in contact with. So I diffused the energy very consciously, intentionally, and carefully.
And those confessions are something you obviously can't talk to anyone about. I mean,
no.
that's pretty big.
Yeah, it is.
Wow.
The trust that I received and continue to now with my Buddhist prison ministry program, but especially inside of guys sharing their history, their past, their hurts, their crimes, their beloveds, you know, their shattered dreams, their tears. The trust that they empowered me with is what drives me today to say yes to these kind of interviews.
Yeah, no, fantastic. Now, you did mention before that one of the inmates committed a crime in your small community, and it was one of my questions further on, but have you ever had any families of victims approach you? I mean, you're very well known out in the world, have you ever had any of the victims' families approach you about inmates that you're working with?
Through the mail.
Okay.
Yeah. And even, well, especially since I started the Buddhist prison ministry, now families of inmates are requesting that I send my workbooks to them.
Yeah.
You know, things like that. But I don't know how, I don't think my face is well known in the world. And certainly living where I do now, that wouldn't happen personally. But I've had some contact with, no, I would say I wouldn't have had contact with inmates I worked with inside, with their family members, I mean.
Yeah.
Only outside.
Now we hear it quite a lot over in the media here. I'm not sure over in the USA, but they say whenever someone's convicted or they've been found guilty of something and they've done something wrong, the first thing they always do is turn to religion. They've found God, they've found this, or they've found something else to try and, you know, get out of. I mean, what are your thoughts on that? I mean, you do hear it a lot here.
Yeah, I know. I don't know if it's the first thing. It might be with some, but I think that depends a lot on what kind of congregation, if there's a congregation.
Yeah.
And also if that inmate it has a lot of fear. You know, the condemning faith traditions are very black and white, right? They're very binary. You do this, you go here. You do this, you go here. And if you've already done this, well, you know, what are you going to do? And you better stay here or you're going to get double hell or, you know. So I think it varies. We had beautiful congregations at San Quentin that were very welcoming, both the Catholic, the Protestant, the Jewish, and the Muslim, the Islam, and the Native American. And so it was a very attractive thing to get into, to have some brotherhood, some, it also depends on the person who is the religious service provider. There are many who do not want anything to do with other faith traditions aside from theirs. And their thinking is very scriptural, very, you know, in the box, not really of the heart. And often prison chaplains are extremely burnt out and have lost empathy hundreds of years ago, if they even show up. And so there's a lot of factors in this, but I can tell you through the spread of the Buddhist prison ministry program in just a short time, now in prisons in every state, by word of mouth, there is such a hunger for transformation. And that's why I also, what I'm so dedicated to is that transformative aspect that I told you about in when you asked about in Buddhism, that is so appealing to inmates, you know, to use their life as compost so that they can build something else, not to condemn themselves for a life of that led to this, but to actually use it and to apply it and to dedicate to one's victims a life spent in service, even on death row. You know, I had one of my early Sangha members get a job. He was a porter, or he picked up garbage or something. And you would have thought this man was sweeping up $1 million bills. He just was so happy to serve. He would just a huge smile all the time and so grateful, you know.
Yeah.
And now, since I left San Quentin, we had a reunion in May with hundreds of the guys that I worked with inside who are on the outside, mainline guys. Many of those have started their own nonprofits having to do with restorative justice, reentry, serving the community, preventing gang intervention, working with politicians. I mean, to see that when one truly does transform, the what the world asked of you is just right there, you know. Some of the guys are getting famous through movies they're in, even like 26-2 to Life, a movie about men who ran in a running club in San Quentin. And this movie is blowing.
Oh, really?
Yeah, blowing film festivals away, left, right, and center.
Wow.
And I helped get a movie filmed in their mantra Sounds into Silence, which also won all kinds of awards. And the scene of Jai Utal and singing kirtan with the man in San Quentin, and they're all dancing, blacks, whites, Chinese, Muslims, Indians, dancing in this, you know, ecstatic way with, I mean, yeah. It, yeah, I'm so excited. I can't even remember the question I was answering.
That's okay. So run me through, if an inmate is, they've been, as an example, just a hypothetical, they've murdered someone on the outside, they're arrested, they're put in a, say, like remand, so in the general population of a prison, then they're sentenced to death. So do they get moved to the death row unit, or they put straight in death row? I mean, is there a process that they go through from the court system?
I don't know for sure, but I think they pretty much land on in the unit.
In the unit. Wow.
Yeah, I did have one guy who, very young guy, and it was like he woke up on death row. You know, it all happened so fast. I'm pretty sure.
Thank you so much for your time, and we will reconnect next week and
okay,
finish off part two.
Oh, very good.
Yeah, fantastic.
So we get to do a part two next week?
We can, yeah, definitely.
Oh, good. Okay. Oh, okay. Good. I'm so excited.
Yeah, me too. I've got a lot more to talk about.
Yeah. Good. Have
okay.
Fun.
Thanks,
okay.
Susan.
Okay, take care.
See you. Bye-bye.
Bye.
That was episode 55 of Talking Prisoner, part one. Please like and share this interview everywhere you can and subscribe to our YouTube channel. This interview will also be available across all the podcast platforms, including Spotify, Apple, iHeartRadio, Google, and anywhere else you get your podcasts from. And it'll also be available on the talkingprisoner.com website. Thank you so much for watching. And please don't forget to subscribe to our YouTube channel, Talking Prisoner, and also follow all our social media, including Instagram, Twitter, TikTok, and Facebook. Thank you so much.
I used to give her roses. I wish I could again. But that was on the outside, and things were different then. We'd build our world together, sharing all the love we'd known, till I had to face the nightmare of waking up alone. On the inside, the sun still shines and the rain falls down, but the sun and rain are prisoners too. When morning comes around, sharing all the love we'd known, till I had to face the nightmare of waking up alone. On the inside, the sun still shines and the rain falls down, sun and rain are prisoners too. When morning comes around, on the inside the roses grow, they don't mind the stony ground, but the roses here are prisoners too. I give her roses. I wish I could again, but that was on the outside. Things were different.